Accession number 31971, Reel 1.
Well, first and foremost, good morning. This is a pleasure and an honor to be asked to come and speak to you. First and foremost, I'm 91 according to my military papers. In reality, I'm in my 89. But in the First World War, you had to be 19 to get in. And when conscription came along, then it was lowered to 18. But we enlisted on the 8th of September 1914, and we went to France on October the 4th. And we went into the trenches in Mele-Mele on the Somme on the night of the 10th with the Argyle and Southern Highlanders. They were supposed to give us instruction on trench warfare. Well, it was trench warfare from then until the 1st of July, 1916, when we went over on the Saturday morning at 20 minutes past 7. Well, you know the outcome of the 1st of July. We being the only division to gain our objectives, our casualties were very, very heavy. We lost 8,000 the first 2 hours we were over. So, having got our objectives, and being cut the way we were with enfilading fire, we were forced to retire. And we had to retire back to where we started from. The divisions on right and the divisions on left weren't able to move. Whether they could or not, I can't answer that, but that's what we were told, they weren't able to move. And of course, we were very embittered about it all. Well, in Northern Ireland today, our book's been published appertaining to the 1st of July, and the remarks passed as, "Oh, for a Patton or a Montgomery." You understand what they meant by that. Having got into the open spaces, it wasn't exploited. We were forced to come back, and it was 3 months after that before the objective was taken at Steepball on the Somme. Well, then we left there, and we went to Plug Street, trench warfare there. And then we left Plug Street and went to Messines. Well, I take it you've all read about Messines Ridge being blown sky high. There was 19 mines on a 6 mile on a 9 mile front from Messines right to Ypres, Hill 60. On that 7th of June was the day of the attack, and we marched up at 2:30 in the morning. And we were made lie on our tummy on the allowed into the trench, the assembly trenches, because the earth was going to vibrate very violently, which it did. But 3:10 was 0 hour when they blew the mines up, so you can understand what it was like. When 19 mines went up on a 9 mile front with a 600 ton ammunition below each, it was dreadful. And every gun sparked at that moment. And it was pitch black dark, and all you could feel was big lumps of boulders hitting you on the back as the earth had been blown sky high. And I was a bomber at the scene, and had a big canvas bucket on me filled with Mills' number 5. It was that heavy when I stood up. I sunk in the ground to the middle of the thighs, with the ground being erupted the way it was. So I just tipped the half of them out. Otherwise, I'd never have been able to walk. However, the idea of carrying the bombs in a bucket, we also could fire them from the rifle. You put a cup on and fixed your bayonet, and you dropped your bomb in and pulled the pin out. The cup held the clip from going forward, you see. And if you couldn't throw the bomb far enough, you used the heel, the same as they do when they're kicking a conversion, and you put the butt of the rifle in and you elevate it or decrest as the case may be. If you fired it too high, it was lost. It only took 4 seconds to explode. So the idea was to get it as low down as you can and get distance. So that was the bombing. And then we shifted again to Ypres. That was just hell. We're up to here in mud and water. It was dreadful. And in Belgium, you can't go down. All your trenches are superimposed with sandbags. And they're getting smashed every day with the artillery fire. So that was Ypres. Then we shifted and came over to St. Quentin. That was over in France. Well, this is the month that we've just finished retiring. You remember? Have you read about the 21st of March? And the British Army in full retreat, they and the French came right back to Amiens. And all that ground that we had fought and won, we had to come back over to Gale. So we started from Amiens again and then went forward. And I was right there until October 1918, when our objective was Courtrai. Courtrai, as they call it in Flemish, was in Belgium, and that was our object. We had just taken Morzeel on this side of it. We had to get over the canal and take the village. And there was three machine guns. Oh, they were playing havoc with our front, and the colonel called volunteers. Well, I being OC, the gun, I got on my feet, and the rest of the gun team came with me. So I got 1, 2, and 3 in a shell, small shell hole, 4, 5, and 6 in another shell hole. With the Lewis gun, it's totally different from the machine gun. It only has a panel that you fit on the top, and it has 47 rounds. So that you have to have a feeding team to keep filling the panels and pass them over. So we done very well. We knocked the first two we could pick out. They're very difficult to find with the way they were concealed. So we knocked the first two out, and there was one on that over here, and I got on my feet to see where he was. And of course I got struck in the hip here. I had that bone splinter come out here and into the other. So I was badly. And he commanded the stretcher bearers couldn't get out for me. This was 11 o'clock I got struck, and I didn't get lifted to 4 o'clock. Of course, all the blood was running up from me. I didn't know it had gone this way, I thought it had gone that way. But there was 4 Germans came in, and of course they cut all the clothes off the back of me to try and mop the blood up and things like that, because it was difficult lying on it when it congealed. It was very hard, you know. So one of these Germans, about an oligarch, took his coat off and covered me. And the 4 of them carried me in. They got it on the strip, on the shoulders, you know. It's easier when you get a thing on your shoulders and you get in step. So they had 5 miles to carry me, because we had gone so far on that the Army Medical Corps hadn't got up. So they used an old French pump to deposit all the wounded in there. So we lay all that day and all that night. We picked up the next morning and taken to another old French barn, as it were. Put you on the floor. And there was a YMCA man come over to me. He says, "Are you hungry?" I said, "I am." And he just broke a wee bit of chocolate and he gave it to me. He wasn't allowed to give me any more because he didn't know. So we lay there all that night, and the next day at daylight they took us down in the Red Cross wagon. Well, in the First World War there was no pneumatic tires, they were all solid. And when they put you on the stretcher and took you in, they had to strap you in, because you would have struck the ceiling sometimes the way they went up and down on the shell road, you know, full of holes. Yeah, they were rolling all over the place. However, they got me down to the Castlebay Clearance Station, and they operated and put me in the hospital trail and sent me down to the Lloyd. So that was me finished for the war, as it were. I was in hospital until February, when I was demobilised and came home, but I was badly crippled for a while, and then I got over it. You wouldn't believe it. In 84, I got crippled again, and I had to use sticks. And I knew the orthopaedic specialist personally, a chap they call Roger Weeks. I went up and told him that I was crippled badly. What could he do for me? So he opened me up and had a look. My goodness, he says, "Have you lived?" That's what he said. Well, he says, "Look, I'm going to take x-rays." And he took x-rays. Well, you know, in the hip joint there's a bearing right round for the joint to work in. Well, on this side, the left side, it was just bone and bone. There was no bearing at all. And there was a new hip joint complete fitted. and I've never looked back since it was put in. Talking about the Western Front and Cold War, it takes its meaning from when there was a lull on the front. And this is when you have to be more particular in your lookout. And we used to have a wee mirror we put on the top of our bonnet and stood the rifle up, and you just looked up at it and it reflected what was taking place on the front line. Well, all the barbed wire was in the front. And you always went out at night on a working party or a patrol just to see how the wire was, because when the wire was erected, you had big stakes with a worm on the end of them, and you just screwed them into the ground. And you made wee clips out of the wire before you went over and put them in your pump. And you put lashing to the stakes, and it was all intercuddled, you know. And then you made round balls, you call them gooseberries, and you threw them in, of course, to slip in there. And then all the tin cans you could get your hands on, you lashed that onto the wire. So when anybody went out there and got caught in the wire, all you heard was the jingling of the cans. Well, naturally, the Lewis guns and the machine guns were all trained on the wire. So whoever was in the wire had a bad time. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the meanings of all quiet, when the lull took place. But you always had to be on guard during the lull, because you never knew. Well, they were the same. They never knew what we were up to, or did we know what they were up to? But occasionally, when we went out on a raid, we went out to get a couple of prisoners, because you were always anxious to know who was holding the front in front of you. And one night we went on a raid, we managed to get two, but I got a crack over the eye, and I can see the earth opening up yet. And I just went back. I was up in a flash, and I didn't know that I was covered in blood until the daylight, and the captain came and he said, "What's wrong, Trimble?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Don't tell lies." I got it. So he just called the stretcher bird over, and they took me down to the clearing station. Right enough, there was a bit of shrapnel in there. Well, they operated and took the shrapnel out and bandaged me up. And whilst I was lying on the stretcher bed, the doctor came and asked me, would I volunteer to save the life of a comrade? What could I say? Yes, sir. So he struck me on the quick of the thumb, and he put his thumb behind like that, and he could have squirted the blood onto the teacher's leg. He squirted it under a section of mirror plate, and he had a box, which was like a lady's little box on the dressing table, and he put it in there, and he took it away. He came back, he says, "You're just the boy we're looking for, group four." In those days, the blood, this is 1916, the blood was 1-1, 2-2, 3-3, and 4 was universal. Now I understand so today, the blood group for being universal. However, they took me away, and they took me into the theatre and put me beside the fellow that I had to give it to. And he was all, this arm was blown right off. It was cracked all down inside. So they put me beside him, and they put a board at right angles, and you put your arm out. And you start working here. But in the meantime, they tied the wrist, they put a bandage around it, and so you could move your arm, you see. And then you start doing this to get the artery to swell. And suddenly I got nipped. I turned around to see what they were up to. And here I just managed to see they had the artery in forceps, and they were holding it like this. They cut the artery, and they insert a glass tube. And on the end of that tube is a rubber leading over to the other table, and a glass tube in the end of that. So they nicked him in the other arm and put it in. And I had to do that, pump it like that. Now, they had to put 3 stitches in that. And then they put a splint on like that, tied it to my neck. And it was the best replica of Nelson you ever seen, in one arm. So that was like they held it for 7 days. They didn't want you working your arm with the stitches. So that was that. And of course the papers were full of it. However the papers got it, I don't know, but he went on to state about this heroic Caldecott's man. But that was my hospital experience, and then when I got this lot, I was in hospital until I was demobilized. But there's one thing I want to tell you. Among soldiers, however the hardship, the British Tommy in particular, was always at his best. And the camaraderie that existed, no family could compare. Hence, when you see these reunions today, how they all gather, they love to meet one another again. Because you would have died for me and I would have died for you. That was just the how serious we took our comradeship. Because if you hadn't enough to eat, I share it with you, and vice versa. And when you got a parcel from home, you just put it on the ground. My mother made two griddles of bread and sent me them every week, and a piece of butter and a bar of chocolate. That came every week. And of course she just, you know, there was three or four, you were always in a group and you were always good friends when you put it down. But this existed throughout, and you always made an understanding that you were blighted, in other words, wounded, and had to go back. The parcel had to be opened. And the same as if you got killed, it had to be opened. So that was one thing I always look back on, the camaraderie that there existed amongst the soldiers. No matter how difficult the hardship was, we could sing.
You were lucky, you survived a couple of experiences in hospital.
Yes, I was wounded on three occasions, a small in the back, the eye and the hip.
Right, what were hospital conditions like? Because in the book that we've read, they're not too sanitary, and in fact one of the boys who goes in with a leg needing amputated ends up dying because of the unsanitary conditions. What were the conditions
like
for you?
They wouldn't be on a par with the hospitals at home, but you've got to remember that when I got the third packet, it's just a marquee we were in. That you hadn't the sanitation there like what you'd have in an hospital. But believe me, everything was done as well as could be done. There was no hardship, take it on me, no hardship whatever. And the nurses were the bravest people in the world. Marvellous. And we used to sing a song, I don't forget it all, the Red Cross nurse in no man's land. The one red rose the soldier knows.
Mm.
Yeah, so I know. But my experience of the hospitals in general was good. I couldn't fault any of them. But when you were on the other side, they weren't on a par with the hospitals in England. Oh, nothing like it. But you appreciated them for all that. You were out of the other end, which where all the violence was. And everybody, the sisters in particular, just couldn't do enough for the Tommy. They were marvellous. So I think any of the women who nursed in either of the wars demands a great lot of respect. So, now if you want any questions.
At this stage, are there boys out there who have got questions who would like to ask Mr. Trimble? I've got a couple more I'd like to ask, but I'd like you to be involved too. Well, while you're thinking about it, perhaps I could ask you about next one. One of the things that I don't think we can appreciate is what the conditions were like in the trenches and what it was like to be in the trenches at the front end.
I'll try and give you an illustration. 1917 was the worst winter we had. And we were in front of the machine trench. Oh, by the way, boys, when we in the trenches, you're in the fire, you're on the fire step. The trenches was like that. And there was always seven of you on the fire step. And you had a password to tackle anybody coming this way or that way. But this particular winter, snow, hail, and remember we didn't have overcoats or anything like that. They had to take them off us because they got that heavy when they got wet and froze up one thing and another. They took them off us all together, and they give us the leather jerkin, which is a leather jacket with no sleeves in it. That's what. And then they introduced the ground sheet. When I joined up first, the ground sheet was just a parallel piece of waterproof. Then they developed the ground sheet that you could make it the form of a cape and button it around your neck. But you weren't allowed to have too much around here, because if you got a gas attack, the idea of that tin strap on your helmet was you just got the hold of your helmet, which was always at the alert, done that, put it on, because you hadn't time to make your mind up and gas was around. But what I'm leading to this winter in 17, there's one morning when the officer came around, I couldn't lift my rifle to challenge him. I was just frozen to death. He says, "What's wrong, Trimble?" I says, "I'm frozen to death, sir." Because standing out all night, you know, we had no cover or anything like that. You were out in the element all the time. And he said, "Okay." And he went away and he got the jar and he poured some rum and some water into this. He says, "Drink that." That was the first thing that warmed me up. Otherwise, I think I would have been frostbitten. And that was the thing we suffered badly in the trenches, frostbite. And in the end, what the natives do when we were going up, we had to take our shoes off and they give us oil called whale oil. And you had to rub your feet before you put your socks on. And after you had rubbed them, the platoon or the section officer always come around and examined your feet to see that you had done it. So once he approved it, you put your socks on and your boots again. But if it hadn't been for the whale oil, we'd have all been in a terrible way. Because your feet never was dry in the winter time. And in Belgium, you can't go down. Water lies about due to the nature of the country and all the dikes outside. You can't dig down. But in France, you could dig trenches. And all these trenches, particularly in France, the communication trench maybe was a mile or a mile and a half long. And they all had London names, such as Piccadilly, Sherwood Avenue, like this. So when you refer to the communication trench, you always refer to it by name. So, but the element and food depended on how you were situated, whether they could get food up or not. They used to put them in a big Dixie. Everything was of a sloppy disposition, because you couldn't have a three-course meal or anything like that. And the one vessel that you had was called your Dixie. You drank out of that, you ate out of it, and when you wanted to wash it, particularly if it was greasy, you just went in a shell hole and got some water and some clay and rubbed right around it and rinsed it. And when you wanted to bring your safety razor out, maybe somebody had a condensed milk tin and you passed that round, maybe done about nine before you changed the water. That's the way you lived. And the vermin, that was one of the great handicaps. You have no idea. Very often when you come out, particularly in the summertime, when you had gone back, you just took your shirt out. And there was no use of washing it. You had to get a candle and rub the seams. It was like a bombardment of these things. They burst in. Vermin, that was one of the things that troubled us most.
You're talking about lice and ticks?
Yes.
What about rats?
We used to have a shop down there again, yeah. Because they, where you get men living like that and bits of food here and there, the rats come around. And then of course when it came to the bread, the platoon sergeant had a very difficult job. Sometimes they would have got, say what would have been divided into three. They used to cut it in slices, three to a loaf. 4 to a loaf, 5 to a loaf, as the case may be. Sometimes it run one slice, sometimes it run two, and so on. But at times you were very hungry, and of course then you just broke the pouch in your tunic here and got your iron rations out and ate the biscuits. That's what you had to do. But food was one of the big drawbacks, particularly if it was a bad section. At Ypres in particular, you never got warm food in the trenches at all. Never. Because we couldn't get up with it in the winter time. And when it rained, it was dreadful. We went up to the 31st of July attack in 1917, and we had our tanks then, but every one of them got bogged. Couldn't move, just sunk in the ground. And the poor old horses, they were strewn all over the place, you know, with the artillery, you know, and the pulling the lumber wagons. It was dreadful. Ypres, I've been there on many occasions since, because I became the London superintendent of the Blue Funnel Line, and I was flown across to Antwerp in 1944. One of our ships was running on an interim certificate, and Lloyds wouldn't renew it. So the filter full of stores sent her over to Antwerp. And she had an awful job trying to get past the wrecks. The Germans had new ships built for Hoboken and put them across the Scheldt in the fairway, and the ships that couldn't get up, particularly the ammunition ships, because Antwerp was a very vital port, as you know. And my chief, Mr. Holt, sent for me and he said, "I'm not putting you in uniform and I'm sending you to Antwerp." So the Royal Air Force flew me over in late 44. Then I had to surrender to the town major, let him know who I was and all the rest of it. And he got a ration card of him to get their food. But and in Antwerp then, you know, it got very bad because the Doodles were coming over. That's the flying bomb. Not the big rocket, the first rocket that was shaped like a plane, you know. They came over very, very frequently. And every time one of them came down, you thought the ship was going to disintegrate. But it was hard times, believe me. And there was no milk, sugar, coffee or anything like that. And I was advised to bring a coffee over and give to the managers and the people who was going to do our work. But the customers only allow you to pick out so much. They were pretty selling it on the black market, as it were. So everything that was very right in Belgium, we got the black market.
Anybody that's got questions?
Do you have a limited amount of ammunition?
Speak up, sir.
Do you have a limited amount of ammunition?
A limited amount of ammunition. Did you have it?
Oh, yes, at first we did. But towards the end, we had plenty. Plenty, because you always your pouch has been filled. You always carried two bandoliers over your shoulder. And there was 150 rounds in each bandolier. Everything was in sections of five. The Lee Enfield Mark III rifle, you could put two clips in the magazine. 10 in the magazine and one in the breech. But we all were never stuck. At first, it wasn't as plentiful, but things formed up, we got all the and then we got any American mills of number 5, the bombs. But I was always of the opinion that the German bomb was a better bomb than ours, because it was like a beetle. You know what a beetle is? With a wooden handle on it. And you could get the German gun like that, pump your head in through your knuckles, stick your hand out in your hand like that and bring it over. A cricketer, a bowler in cricket was supposed to make a very good bomb. That's what we were always told. Because he could lay on, you see. But the German bomb, you could get it and throw it far enough. With that hand, you know. Got good distance out of it. But the Germans were very efficient, there's no doubt about it. And they introduced a gun, a light field gun, and it was a high velocity shell. We used to call it a whiz bang. All you heard was whiz bang. That's all you heard. That was the German light gun. The same as our 18 pounder was our light gun. That was the Royal Field Artillery. They had two guns, 18 pounder and 4.5, then the Royal Garrison Artillery after that, and then the Royal Marine Artillery after that. But the Royal Horse Artillery, they had the 13 pounder and they became anti-aircraft.
Is there anybody else that says, yeah. Is there a lot of enthusiasm to go to war?
A big pardon?
Did a lot of people want to go to war?
Oh, enthusiasm knew no bounds in 1914. New Lubarns, there was a lot, of course, didn't want to go, but then everyone that didn't want to go, two did. Oh, there was. We'd never had a conscript in our division. we led voluntary recruits in Great Britain.